So everyone settle down. Now we start this evening's talk. And like many of the talks, this comes from an email someone sent me asking me to, can you please talk about... It's exciting, isn't it? You come here, you don't know what I'm going to talk about. Sometimes I don't know too until I open my mouth. But no, this time it's about motivation. Why do we do things? And why is it that sometimes we lose our motivation? And of course, you all know what it's like sometimes when you lose your motivation. You get depressed, you get upset, and you can't even get out of bed in the morning. You wonder, what's the purpose? And exactly, what is the purpose there? And why can't we actually motivate ourselves? And you find at the very beginning of your life, you know, you're motivated because people tell you what to do. But there comes a time in your life you have to self-motivate. It's not following rules and regulations or orders anymore. You're no longer an automaton. You have to self-motivate your life. And why? What do you actually do? I know that sort of the sort of thing which motivated me when I was a young man were girls. I mean, that's when you're a young guy, and that's what you're interested in. And I must admit, I make a confession over here, I do exploit that. Because every now and again we have these working bees and busy bees at our monasteries. And I found this the very first year when I was trying to build our monastery down at Serpentine. You get people just helping, just work at the monastery, and mostly the guys doing the heavy work. And the girls, they had these Thai girls. It's the custom in Thailand. Whenever you go to the monastery, they always dress up. You know, you can't stop them. It's a custom. And so they get these young, pretty Thai girls would dress up when they came to the monastery. I'd always invite them to come a bit closer to the guys who were working. Because it's the nature of a guy. You'd work even harder if you see a pretty girl. And so I use that to exploit, to get the most work out of these guys, just having some girls around. It works. It's really good. So total exploitation. That's the thing about being a monk. We know psychology. We know what motivates people to show off. And you get a pretty girl and the guys really show off and they try and dig the hole faster. As far as I'm concerned, I'm just happy to get the hole dug. But isn't that the case? A lot of times, what really motivates us is to try and impress other people. And that's something in your life, you know, you look at and you focus on. And that really sucks, doesn't it? You spend all your life trying to please other people. And what do you get out of it? Criticize, not good enough, you're hopeless. It's just so hard. We really, really, really work hard trying to please and trying to do the best job we possibly can. And of course, we're imperfect. No one ever can actually meet those high standards. And so because of that, in the end, we get to this. We lose our motivation for trying to please others. At least I hope you do. Hope you're coming here not trying to please others, but trying to find another way of motivating your life. Because look, that's what really runs our societies, isn't it? Why do people have big cars? Look, it's a waste of time. Just actually last week, going back from here, back to Serpentine, down the freeway, we went behind a Lamborghini. And it's a Lamborghini car. I said, hey, look, that's a Lamborghini. It was stuck in the traffic just like us. What's the point of having a Lamborghini in heavy traffic? And even if you do put your foot down, you get caught by the speed cameras. It's a total waste of time. Why? Getting a Lamborghini doesn't get you anywhere faster than just an old Ford or Honda or whatever you've got. I should be careful here, or because this talk is not being sponsored by Ford or Honda or Hyundai or Toyota. I've got to be careful to mention everybody, otherwise I get into big trouble. But you don't get there faster. So why do people actually buy a fast, expensive car? What's the point of it? Of course, you all know the point. Look at me. I'm in a fast car. I've made it in life. Have you made it? You're just an idiot, that's all. Wasting all your money just on a fast car. You know, I must admit, though, I must put my hand up that once I really enjoyed myself one day because, you know, I went into a stretch limo once. You know the occasion? I was in the back of a stretch limo because part of being a monk, doing funeral services. And... it's the only time I've been in a limo. Because what actually happened, it was a sad occasion because this family of Buddhists, know, the first child, you know, died. You know, it was born with complications, and after a few months, they tried their very best. The doctors gave 100%, trying to keep this kid alive, but you know, sometimes it doesn't work. So the child died, and the parents, they were just too upset actually to go to the funeral service. So they asked me, "Can I just go with the casket, you know, to the crematorium and just do a little bit of Buddhist chanting? It'll just be myself, the two funeral directors, and the coffin." And of course, you know, they wanted to send their kid off in the best possible way, so they hired a stretch limo for it. So there was, like, you know, have you ever been in a stretch limo? It's a huge car, and it's these two seats like facing each other. So, you know, in the front was the little coffin, which was only a tiny thing. No one could see that. And I was in the back, and these two uniformed drivers were in the front. And so every time we stopped at the traffic lights, this was about maybe 20 years ago when the first stretch limos came, people actually, you know, looked through the window to see who was this guy with two uniformed chauffeurs in a stretch limo. And of course, when they looked through the window, they couldn't see the coffin, they could just see me. So I waved regally at everybody. You really enjoy playing around as a monk like that. But why do people actually have big stretch limos or big cars? Why do they have even big houses? It's only because to show off and because you're worried what people think of you. That's all. It's only for status. And after a while you think, look, that costs so much money. That's so much stress. That caused me so much pain getting a big house or a big car. I have to worry about where I park it in case somebody steals it. I got to pay all this insurance for my house. I got to worry about security in case somebody comes and robs my house. I got to clean it. Think of your poor house cleaners there. Such a huge house. You have to spend so many hours cleaning and maintaining it. Imagine you're like a monk or a nun, just lived in one room. Isn't that wonderful? You can only be in one room at a time. So, you know, just have a small house. You can have your TV in there, your bed in there at night time, a little place for cooking. You know, it's very easy to get these instant foods these days, you know, just boil it up or whatever. So it's so easy. Just imagine how small your house can be and just how easy it will be to clean. That means you have all this spare time, free time. You don't have to worry about anything. So look, why is it we have such huge houses these days? It's just to show off, because we're worried what other people think about us. The same with the clothes and everything else. That's not a good reason to motivate your life. It costs too much, and it also just drives you crazy after a while. And as the old story goes, it's usually the people who are so worried what other people think of you, the ones who are really concerned about not self-esteem, but peer pressure, are the young people. Teenagers in your 20s, that's the time you are most concerned what other people think about you. But sometimes when you get into your 40s, you know, you can dress daggily, you can don't have to worry about your makeup or hair, you know, because you're past that. You just take it easy. Don't give a damn what other people think of you in your 40s and 50s. That's the next stage in life. The first stage in life, you really concern what other people think of you. 40s or 50s, you don't give a damn what people think of you. And finally, you wake up in your 60s, you find out the secret, that people weren't thinking about you anyway. And if you could only realize that when you were young, you'd have a much better life. So if you are someone who is really sensitive to other people's opinions and criticism of you, you have a lot of suffering. If that's what motivates your life, you're really asking for a lot of trouble, because people will criticize you, they will put you down. If that's the most important thing in your life, you'll soon get depressed. And a lot of depression comes from that. You lose your motivation working so hard to please other people, and it doesn't work, so you give up trying. That is not the best motivation for your life. So what other motivations can we have instead of trying to please other people? Obviously, the pleasure principle is an important part of life. You know, we do things because we enjoy it. Now, that's not such a bad principle, as long as we realize what we really do enjoy in life. Why do people go out and get drunk at night? Because they think they enjoy it. It motivates them. They're looking for some happiness and pleasure. Why sex? Why movies? But look, if you, you know, do too many movies or too much sex, after a while, there is satiation, just too much. You think, just what's the point of this? Because the physical pleasure principle, if that's what motivates you in life, after a while you get jaded, is the word. If that's all you really want in life, is this it? And so that doesn't really work, just, you know, going for physical pleasure. Which is one of the reasons why a lot of you are here this evening. Yeah, you've been there, you've done that. Surely there must be something else which gets us out of bed in the morning, motivates us. And that physical pleasure which I was talking about, it's more like for me. Then we get into some higher motivations, which are just the motivations for compassion and caring for other people. And that's a much greater motivation. So once you've got sort of worrying what other people think of you and just the pleasure, the, you know, sensual pleasure principle, you go for compassion. Now that is a far greater motivator for a person. And it's something which is a sustainable motivation. It can really get people going in life, just wanting to do things for others. But there's a danger with that compassion, because sometimes that compassion can turn into the negative motivations. And the negative motivations is, the government is hopeless, the government is terrible, out of compassion we should get rid of this government. Those Buddhists who don't believe in God, they're terrible, we should get rid of them. You know, a lot of times, a lot of wars are started by a perverted sense of compassion. Really think that these people need to be got out of the way. They need to be culled. They need to be removed. And that's why that for many, even when I was very young, you saw the sort of the problem with that negativity. You know, it's very easy to give a talk and to get people really riled and angry. And you know, if you ever heard a talk like that where people are just, they're taking an issue, whether it's like live animal exports or whether it's violence or prostitution, child prostitution or any issue which can really sort of get under people's skin. It's very easy to get people motivated through anger and negativity. I remember just, I try and avoid that because part of my ethos of being a monk is to be a pacifist and not to sort of encourage those bad emotions. But I remember that once I did accept an invitation to go to a, well, I don't know if it was really a political demonstration, because Dennis was there with me that time. It was, you know, just before the invasion of Iraq, the Iraq War. I think it was the first one, wasn't it, or the second one. I don't know which one it was. I can't remember now. So I accepted the invitation to go to the State Parliament House, you know, on the steps where the demonstrations are, and just give a little speech. And I wasn't trying to be political. I was just trying to be just pacifist. And come on, you don't need to invade a country. There's other ways to solve problems. And it's just going to cause huge amounts of suffering, you know, real suffering afterwards. So I thought I should go there. But I was very concerned because as soon as I started talking about, you know, sort of, you know, we shouldn't send the troops into Iraq, and all the orders, yeah, no troops in Iraq. And I had to be very careful because even just one word and people get motivated with like anger and irritation. And that was such a dangerous thing to actually to see that happening in giving a talk and actually arousing people's what they thought was righteous indignation, justifying anger, because you could see just how that could motivate people to violence. Seeing that was just really dangerous. And so be careful. Don't motivate people through anger and through violence. It's very easy to do. And of course, if you are attending any sort of talk or any rally like that, you get a high. Because when you're motivated out of anger, there's a cause, there's a problem which needs to be solved. And it's amazing the amounts of energy you can generate inside of you, you know, through anger. Now, there's a really big problem there. And so the way to overcome that type of motivation, you've got to, you know, which is a perverted type of compassion. You really think you're doing the best for other people. You really feel you're solving the problems of the world. You really think that there's somebody who should be taken out of the way because they're causing too much suffering for other people. That is just so dangerous. And as a Buddhist, no, don't go down that path of motivating people through anger. It just turns on yourself. The anger is a little demon which you set free. And once it's set free, it's going to turn on you. And it's going to destroy you as well. So whatever cause you have, whatever is right, it's not the sort of, this is part of the motivation. It's not motivation to try and solve the problems of you know, what's going to happen in the future. The problems are always in the present moment. The problem is that anger. The problem is that violence. It's motivating a person to actually to make sure the process is correct rather than the outcomes. Looking at the process. It's not what you're trying to achieve, but how you're trying to achieve it. Because, yeah, if you use violence to get rid of a wrong, you find usually that you create another wrong. It's a little poem which I remembered from the time I was at university from William Blake. And I think I mentioned this at that talk at Parliament House. Vengeance to the tyrant fled and caught the tyrant in his bed and slew the wicked tyrant's head and became a tyrant in his stead. And that's just such a beautiful little statement there, which notice that the people who actually are motivated through righteous indignation, through the just cause, what they think is a just cause, and express their anger and violence, they usually become the tyrant in the future. They don't solve the problem. They just transfer the problem from our enemy to us. We do become our enemy. So that's why, if you are motivating, please don't use like this perverted type of compassion, which is like anger. Because you be careful there, because you really think it's justified. You're doing the right thing because you think these people need to be taught a lesson. These people need to be saved. Please don't go that path. So instead, we have that the real kindness of compassion. The kindness of compassion is like realizing, this is basic law of karma of Buddhism, that if you want to have a peaceful, beautiful, happy, successful, harmonious world, you have to make it in this present moment. It's now. So if you make moments of peace, if you make moments of kindness, if you do little acts of compassion now, that is how we get the beautiful future. And so you don't make a beautiful future with moments of anger and violence and ill will. It's a longer road. It's a tougher journey. But it's the only way which works. Sort of anger arises very quickly. And it lasts a long time, at least its effects will last a long time. Anger can sometimes be spontaneous, and violence is very fast. But its effects go down generation after generation after generation. You know that I do go travelling a lot, and just early this year, last year, I went over to Frankfurt to teach a retreat. It's the second time I've been over there. And there's one thing which I noticed, which actually people told me, because this particular temple was spending a lot of time doing counseling for people. And what they were counseling people was post-traumatic stress disorder from the Second World War, which finished over 66 years ago. And these were people who were never born, who weren't born during the war, they were born afterwards. But still the trauma of that huge conflict in Europe has still trickled down the generations. And people who are born 20, 30, 40 years after the end of hostilities were still suffering the trauma of that war. At first it was unbelievable to me. But when I sort of investigated further, yes, that was still there. And you can just see just violence arises quickly, but spends many years passing through generations. It lasts such a long time. And the opposite way of building peace, that's just so hard to build. It takes many, 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 many years to build it up. But once it is there, it just heals and lasts for such a long time. That's why it's much harder to motivate yourself with compassion, because it's a longer haul. It takes more time. But it's also, you can actually feel, you know it's the right thing to do. Because a lot of time with finding the right motivation, we have to be far more sensitive to our feelings and thoughts inside. And there's a little story, a little anecdote which I wanted to put in here, which one of the main reasons I wanted to give this talk and fit this one in here. I heard this little story when I was in Phuket. It's just it's putting together motivation and also one's mindfulness of actually knowing what one is doing and why one is doing it. Because a lot of times for many people, you don't understand what your motivations are. The whole inner world is a confusion. It's a jungle. And to be able to actually to find out what does one want or why does one want to do it, what is actually motivating you? There's a little story about someone making a choice in their life. They're making a choice. Now, what might the choice to be? To buy a hamburger or to buy sort of some sushi. What are you going to have for dinner tonight? And when you cannot decide to buy a hamburger or get sort of some healthy sushi, so what a person does, they toss a coin. Heads, hamburger; tails, sushi. But when they toss the coin and it comes up tails, sushi, that's disappointing. Let's try 2 out of 3. Have you ever done that? Now, what that actually means, it is actually showing you that you don't want the sushi, you want the hamburger. And that was one of the best things about tossing a coin when you make a decision. Because tossing a coin doesn't tell you which path to go. It doesn't tell you what you're going to do. It tells you what you really want to do. And if you toss a coin and it comes up, heads, yeah! Then it shows you that's what you always want to do in the first place. If you toss your coin, bleh, then that is revealing your emotional bias, what you really want to do. Or not just your emotional bias, that's the wrong word to use, bias, but your intuition, your intuitive knowledge of what you really want and what's really happening inside. And so a lot of time, the tossing the coin method is not a way of making decisions, but it's a way of finding out what you really want to do. It's uncovering your motivations, the why and what. So it's a very beautiful way. And anyone who comes wants to make a decision in life. And a lot of times you come and bother me when you want to make decisions. Ajahn Brahm, should I change my job? Ajahn Brahm, should I carry on with this guy or should I dump him because he did this and did that? But you know, a lot of times, those of you who are counselors, you know why you actually come and talk to a person? You don't come and talk to the counselor or to the monk or to the nun actually to get a decision from them. You just come to actually to find out what you want to do. A lot of times people come up and they talk to me about some enormous decision they're making in life. And at the end, I end up saying, well, you've already told me what you want to do. Because you can tell from what they're saying, they're always biased towards one side or the other side. They're telling you what you want to do. And so I say, well, you just told me what you want to do. He said, yes, that's actually why I was talking to you. They just want to find out what they want to do. They don't want to be told. And of course, that's what you can do with a coin. And you can actually save a lot of money going to professional counselors doing that. But it's actually revealing what your motivation, what you want to do and why you want to do it. And a lot of times, you know, your intuition is pretty accurate. I think it's pretty honest and it's pretty pure. It's usually when you get into the thinking mind, that's usually sort of stuffs things up because people think in such weird ways. And they think it's logical, but it's totally illogical. The feeling inside, I've got this great trust that the feeling inside human beings, their idea of what's right and what's wrong, what's good, what's kind, is there. It's inside of you. And if you actually trust that much more than any words, any philosophies, any religions, or any logic, if you trust what's inside, that's usually far more dependable. And when I heard this story, they actually said that there's been research done which actually showed, yes, it is much more dependable. You usually make much better choices when you feel them rather than you think them. And you follow what you really feel you need to do. That's usually far more dependable. So that is actually getting into the heart of this motivation, finding out what you really want to do. And if you follow that way, you usually find out it is real compassion and kindness. You really want to do the best for everybody. But of course, when you're motivated, I already mentioned an important part, it's the best for everybody. Because sometimes what motivates people, what they think is kindness and compassion, is not kindness and compassion. Sometimes that they do this, they're acting, and they left an important person out of the equation. There's another story I haven't told for a long time. In ancient India, many hundreds of years ago, the education system was such that you went with a one teacher, and the teacher had many, many disciples, and he taught you everything. It's like what they call a polymath. And once you graduated from your teacher, then you could actually set yourself up as a teacher. So in ancient India, many, many centuries ago, there was a very famous teacher who'd only receive a limited amount of disciples, and he taught them many, many things, not just things like medicine and calculation, astronomy, and all these other arts which were there at the time, but he also obviously taught them to be good people. Now, what happened when they were just all about close to graduation? He wanted to give them a test, but it wasn't just a test to see how much they learnt over those years. He also had another problem, and that problem was his daughter, who was of marriageable age. And it was the custom in those days to have arranged marriages, and being a teacher, he was supposed to marry off his daughter to his best disciple. So he brought all of the guys together and said, "You know my daughter, she's very pretty, I know you all like her, you know you'll all love to marry her, and I got to choose which one should marry. And it's also to give her, find out which of you has learnt the most over all the years you've been with me. So I decided to give you a test to find out who's the smartest and the most obedient. But also, I have another problem. You know, when people get married, they need to find themselves a house, or at least a little hut. You know, they've got to get their sort of their basic necessities of life together. And he said, "I've got to find some money for the two of you, and I'm so poor. So in order to, in the old days, I would say, kill two birds with one stone, but being a Buddhist now, I don't use that. I say, cut two carrots with one knife." You know, you've got to use Buddhist terminology these days. It's a terrible, kill two birds with one stone, that's a terrible. So cut two carrots with the same knife. It's a much better one. So in order to cut two carrots with the same knife, he said, "This is the test I'm going to give you. I need some money. I've also got to find out who's the smartest. So I want each one of you to go into the local villages at nighttime to steal, take whatever you can find, and bring it back. And what we all steal, we'll give to the winner of this competition. And the one who steals the most will win my daughter." You know, everyone was really shocked. The guy was asking him to steal. This was terrible. And he said, "No, look, this is what I want you to do, but one important point. Make sure no one sees you steal. And so, make sure no one sees you steal." So, all the boys went in the middle of the night, creeping through the villages, waiting till the people went to sleep or they went out, and they crept into the houses, and they stole this and they stole that, and they brought it back to their teacher, and their teacher would keep a meticulous record of what they stole and from where. And at the end of the period of 1 week, the teacher brought all the students together and said, "You've all stolen lots and lots of stuff. There's enough here to keep the happy couple, you know, rich for a long time. You're going to be very comfortable. You've all stolen a lot." And they're always waiting to see which one has stolen the most. And the teacher said, "You've all stolen a lot except for one of you." And this one little student was very ashamed and embarrassed. He said, "Why didn't you steal anything?" And he said, "Because I followed your instructions, teacher. But my instructions were to steal." He said, "Yes, well, I tried. But you also told us, if anyone is watching, don't steal. He said, I went into the houses at night. I waited till no one was there. And I went in there and I saw these valuable items. I went to pick it up and I realized someone was looking. Me. I was seeing me steal. That's why I couldn't follow your instructions. And of course, the teacher said, at last I've got one wise disciple. After all I've taught you about self-responsibility, it's true that other people won't see you, but you see you. And he said, that's the only student that's followed my instructions. After all these years, only one of you is wise enough, so you can marry my daughter. And as for all this stuff you've stolen, I'm rich enough, I don't need it. Take it back to where it came from. And don't worry, because I told all the villagers to expect you. This was a set-up, a scam, to find out how many of you knew what it meant not to steal if someone is watching. And of course, that's yourself. How many of you realize that you count? It's not just other people watching. You're watching you. So when you understand that, the idea of compassion is not just the wrong compassion. It's just compassion just for other people. Forgetting you. You count as well. So motivation of compassion, what really works is when, yeah, it is for the well-being and happiness of all people, including yourself. You count too. And that's one of the reasons why motivation out of compassion, that wrong compassion when it's for others and you're not included, that's why also that does not work. You get burnt out. You feel there's nothing in it for you. And again, you get depressed. It's a motivation which doesn't work. You have to be included in the equation. You count too. Otherwise, you lose all your motivation. You won't do anything in life. It reminds me of another story about motivation about this migrant who came to Perth. And he came over from the Middle East. And he heard all these stories about Australia and how rich Australia is. And compared to some of these really, really poor countries, war-torn, ravaged countries, living in great poverty with hardly anything to eat or ravaged by floods or whatever else is a natural disaster, some people are really, really dirt poor. And compared to them, it's true, Australia is a very, very wealthy country. And so in the refugee camps waiting to be resettled in Australia, he heard, the streets of Perth are paved with gold. I've heard that saying before. And of course, he didn't really believe it. But as soon as he arrived at Perth Airport on the migrant visa, as soon as he walked out of the airport, he looked down and there was a $2 gold coin on the floor. My goodness, the streets of Perth are paved with gold. And so he went down to pick up the gold coin. And then he stopped himself and said, no, I've just arrived. I won't start work until tomorrow. That's called laziness. So anyway, to real motivate yourself, compassion for yourself and compassion for other people, you actually care. Now, if you get that as your motivation, that actually works. Because that gives you a meaning. Because the compassion, the care, is trying to get the greatest happiness, peace, whatever it is, for yourself and others. And if that's what motivates your life, then you're getting somewhere. I always remember I was inspired by reading a passage in the ancient sutras, the teachings of the Buddha, where one day the Buddha took a nap in the afternoon. And then this being called Mara called him out. I've caught you out. You're not a real monk. You're lazy. Look, all these other people have to work hard feeding you. They're not sleeping during the middle of the day, you lazy monk. He said, what are you doing that for? Why are you sleeping? And the Buddha replied, I'm laying down for the happiness and benefit of all sentient beings. And I thought, what a great answer that was. So whenever I take a nap and say, what are you doing, Ajahn Brahm? You should be doing something, working. You've got these letters to write, emails. You should be counseling someone, teaching someone, writing a book. You should be doing something. And say, I'm taking this nap for the happiness and benefit of all sentient beings. No, I'm being serious now. Why do you need to do that? Because isn't it the case that you need it too? Remember, other people have to put up with you. So if you're taking a rest, if you're taking a break, if you're giving yourself some peace and relaxation, it's other people get the benefit from that. Because when you're really tired, you're tense, you're upset because you're physically tired and drained, that's why people get grumpy and upset and angry. I gave a talk about that a few weeks ago. One of the great reasons why people get angry is because they're tired. I mean, really, really tired. They haven't given themselves a rest or a break. And if we took all the angry people in this world and just put them in a 5-star resort and gave them a rest, when they came out afterwards, I'm sure they'd be much better people. They wouldn't be so angry, would they? So if you've got a boss from hell, I mean, many people have got boss from hells, make a collection in the office and send them to Cable Beach for a couple of days. When they come back afterwards, oh, you're such a lovely people in the office. Do you want a promotion? Do you want a raise? I don't know, but at least it get rid of a lot of their anger and upset. And I think you understand that because you know that from your own personal experience, don't you? When you're really tired, you get grumpy. So sometimes the motivation for the benefit and happiness of all sentient beings gives yourself a break. You count too. And that motivation is not just giving yourself sleeping all day and all night, but it's also motivating yourself that there is some good to be done in this world. There is some beautiful things to happen. There's a lot which we can do to make a better world. And that is what motivates you, because you live in that world too. So our motivation is for the happiness and peace of all beings. You're included. Now, how that actually pans out in your life, what you can do, I'm not sure what you can do, but there's a lot we can all do together. I spent my whole life building monasteries or building Buddhist centers or writing books and giving talks like this. And sometimes I ask myself, what am I doing this for? Haven't I given enough talks? Apparently on these little iPods now, you get, someone said about 250 Ajahn Brahm talks, and they're selling it for about $10. I've worked out it was about 5 cents a talk. That was really dispiriting. This talk only worth 5 cents. But anyway, no, you don't. You're motivated just for the fun of it, and because it's worth doing, and because it makes people more peaceful and happy. And when you get a bit of feedback, that really, really, really does motivate you to try even harder. And, you know, you do get that feedback. Someone comes along and says, you know, that talk or that little saying you did saved my life. It stopped me hanging myself, stopped me kidding myself. And there's a huge amount you can do, you know, with these teachings. That positive energy which you can give out really, really can make a difference in this world. And, of course, that means you are actualizing your motivation for the benefit and happiness of all other beings, you can do something. And each one of you can do an enormous amount, even if it's just, you know, smiling at people every day. I think he's not here today, but where is he? Chris Perrier. He did this little happiness seminar, I think a few months ago, where he was just asking people, giving people a little task to do. Go out there into the community, smile at someone or give person a dollar or whatever it is, just these small acts of kindness and just to see its effect. And of course, once you get into that and notice how it works, your small act of kindness comes back to you manyfold. It's called the law of karma. It means you motivate yourself. It encourages that motivation. It strengthens the motivation to work harder, to make a better world, to be kinder. You don't need to do big things. Just small little acts of kindness. You know, somebody just, you know, needs a hand. Somebody just needs someone to talk to. Someone just needs someone to smile, to get a smile from. It's amazing, just small things, just how much they mean to other people. And if you can just do that, it's amazing just how much happiness and peace that you can make in this world, how you can actualize, you know, compassion and realize its benefits. And what happens is like a snowball effect. the more you actually, you know, motivate yourself to be kind, the more actually you get sort of feedback, and that increases the motivation. And you just get into this, just trying to be kind, trying to be compassionate, and it becomes a great source of fulfillment and happiness in life. Doing something good. So at the end of the week, you know, you look and see, what have I done? What have I done to make other people happy, to make a better world, to be a more beautiful, peaceful world? And when you actually look at what you've done, if it's just, you know, help somebody, just be kind, just spoken to somebody, just, you know, allowed someone just to come in front of you, you know, in the traffic jam. Whatever it is, just one small act of kindness. And you look back upon your week and say, wow, I did that, what a wonderful thing that was. That's why when people do ask me about depression and how to overcome depression, there's one very simple method which is highly effective. And it does not need any counseling or meditation or any medication. It's a simple thing of doing some social service, doing some voluntary work. Just coming to a temple, an old people's home, a church, a mosque, a prison, or any place, and just doing something for others. And just a small little act of just coming to this place and just sweeping the grounds or just doing a bit of gardening. It's amazing just how much happiness you get back. When I was a student, okay, I was a student, stupid, you know, just learning about, you know, the meaning of life. But I was a Buddhist. I decided to become a Buddhist when I was 16. And when I went to university, of course, most of my friends were Christians. And I, you know, I was really worried about what other people thought of me, and especially what they thought about Buddhism. So I was very, very competitive when, you know, in religion when I was at university. So if the Christians did something, I had to do better. So when I found out a couple of my Christian friends were doing voluntary work in this hospital for people with Down syndrome, I said, I'm going to go too. It was just competition. It was nothing sort of noble at all. It wasn't really compassion. But I started going and spending everything Thursday afternoon in Forborne Hospital just outside of Cambridge, just doing a bit of voluntary OT work, occupational therapy work, with these Down syndrome kids. I know my Christian friends, they dropped out after 2 or 3 weeks. I kept on going there for 2 years. And they told me I was the longest volunteer they'd ever had in that hospital. Now, I'm not feeling good about myself and just how proud I was to be able to do that. Because when they actually told me, I said, well, what's the problem? I just really enjoy doing this. Even though you were a student, had many other things which were important in your schedule, just going and doing a little bit of social work like that gave me a huge boost of energy. Those days, those Thursday mornings when I woke up, oh, this is the day I'm going to the hospital today. I really look forward to it. So much so that there was one day just towards the end of my time volunteering that, you know, I was so competent by this stage. They trusted me so much. They gave me a whole group to myself while they had a rest and did their paperwork. It's probably totally illegal just letting a volunteer look after the whole class, but, you know, they could trust me. So they gave me one class before the tea break and another class after the tea break. What I didn't realize, there was only 2 classes. During the other class, they were getting all of these Down syndrome kids to make me little presents. And, you know, the first class, you know, which I was teaching, the other class did the presents the first session. When I swapped over, the other class did the presents for the second session. And afterwards, they made this presentation to me because they said I was the longest serving student they'd ever had. They wanted to make a presentation, and they thought it was like I was doing the final examinations the next week, so I wouldn't be able to come. You know, that was one of the most moving times of my life. And these Down syndrome kids, who I'd come to respect and love, they were friends. You'd go up there to the hospital, and they'd run towards you and give you a hug. And to me, a boy in the, you know, 60s and 70s being hugged by another boy, now I was heterosexual. To receive that from another guy was very tough for me. They taught me, you know, emotional intelligence. Because they were incredibly smart. Now, emotionally, intellectually, they couldn't do anything. But emotionally, they could tell if I was in a bad mood. They'd give me a hug to cheer me up, and it worked. So I got to know these. It was like family. These were like, you know, brothers to me. And sisters. There was girls there as well. And it was really moving to give me this presence. And they really meant it, because they thought I was leaving. So they were crying. It was a beautiful experience, but I told them afterwards, excuse me, but I'm not doing my exams for another couple of weeks. Can I please come next week? And they allowed me to come even after my final day. But I really enjoyed that so much. And just that little bit of service gave me a huge boost. It was only afterwards I realized what it was doing. It was motivating me to actually to do more, to be kinder, simply because you get such incredible feedback. So look, I don't care how busy you are in your work and how much jobs you have with your family. Please go further with your compassion and kindness. Do voluntary work. It's not something which is going to cost you, but it's going to get a huge amount of feedback back, a great degree of happiness. And you're realizing that the greatest motivation in this life is for the benefit and happiness of all other beings, especially if you go to a group which really needs it. If you look after your temple, if you look after your monasteries, if you look after your churches, your mosques, your hospitals, your synagogues, I don't care where, look after them. Get into it. And you get so much happiness back. So the greatest motivation is for the happiness and benefit of all sentient beings. And you're part of that. It's not just for, that's what I realized, it wasn't just for these Down syndrome kids, it was for me. I was part of it. And so whatever I gave to them, I got back. Whatever I got back, I gave. And that became the meaning of my life. So like even now, sometimes people say, oh, you're a monk, you left the world, you don't do anything for other people. Yeah, sure I don't. Going giving talks, helping out. And I really get off on this. So that's why somebody asked me, why did you become a monk in the first place? That's, you know, such a long time ago. I don't really remember. I often say that maybe it was because, and this is actually logical, it makes sense. Maybe the reason I became a monk was because of a broken heart and I became a monk to forget. The reason is because I can't remember anything like that at all, so I suppose it's reasonable. It could have happened. I've forgotten. But no. The reason I became a monk was because I enjoyed being a monk. But the most important thing, why do you stay as a monk? There's all these things you could do in this world. Why are you staying as a monk? And because you get this enormous happiness back. And why do I work my butt off as being a monk? You know, teaching here and teaching there. If you see some of the schedules, you know, when I do any teaching, or when the other monks or nuns do teaching, it's a huge schedule. No one else would work that many hours for such little pay. One bowl of food a day, and maybe a cup of tea if you're lucky, and a bit of chocolate. No super, no pension fund. That's why I can't retire. I'm getting old now, but I'm not looking forward to my retirement. I can't. But why do you do these things for? It's obviously that you've all seen me long enough. You really get off on this. You get a lot of happiness and joy out of this life. And I sometimes ask me, what do I get happiness and joy out of? It's actually serving and helping. Sometimes you just meditate alone. You get a huge amount of motivation through peace. But you also get motivated just by being of service. A huge amount of happiness. A huge amount of fulfillment. And sometimes if you want to ask what the meaning of life is, it's this. Caring. Caring for others. Caring for yourself. And not just thinking it, but actually doing it. And of course, that really, really motivates you. Your motivation grows out of all proportions. Because the more you give, the more you get. The more you want to give, the more you get back. The more power you have to give. So that's in your life, to really motivate yourself. So this is not just a religion of philosophy and just things which we argue over. This is a religion or a path of spirituality, whatever you want to call it, which actually works, which actually gets people going and makes a better world. Small things first of all and bigger things later on. It makes a much kinder, warmer, happier society. What a beautiful thing that is in our world. And it also means once you get into this depression business and this waking up in the morning and saying, oh, gee, You know, what do I have to do today? Go to work again. Oh, God, how long do I have to do this for? Oh, it's another Saturday morning. I've got to go and take the kids to school, to their sports. I've got to go and just do this and do this. I mean, so much depression in this world because one is not really motivated. And the reason why it's not motivated, one doesn't know where to put that motivation. If it really is for kindness, compassion, for really doing things for other people, you get up early in the morning, whoopee, zippity-doo-dah, another day. I can come to Nottamara today to give a talk. Hooray, whoopee. I can go and give a talk somewhere else this morning. I can go and do some counseling. I can go visit people. I got a funeral this morning. Whoopee. No, you know, actually, I do enjoy funeral services and marriages as well, because you can make a difference. You can take these important parts of people's lives and turn them all around. Still remember this, one of the first funeral services I did over here in Perth. There was this young guy, he was from UK, and he's only about 23, 24. He developed cancer, it was terminal. And he was over in one of the first hospices, which was, over in Netherlands by the river, the old hospital over there somewhere. What was it called again? Netherlands or Dalkeith somewhere? Bethesda, okay, that sounds right, Bethesda. Anyway, so I went to see him in there, and you know, there's nothing you could really do. You know, he was dying, but he was a Buddhist. So when he actually died, and I did the funeral service, his parents came over from UK. And his parents were just this quintessential, like, country folk from UK. You know, they lived in a village. They were very, very formal, very conservative, very Christian. And when they saw me come into the room for the funeral of their only son, just their drawers dropped. Oh, God, what's doing the funeral for our only son? And that's actually what I started off with. You could see just, it was almost like disappointment, very severe disappointment. This was their only son who died tragically of cancer. And this guy in a funny robe was doing the funeral service for them. At the end of the funeral service, about 25 years ago, they were so impressed, they gave a $500 donation, you know, just out of joy. And they made a decision that when they die, that I have to do their funeral service for them, and also that their ashes would get spread at Bodhinyana Monastery. They became really, really good friends. The mother died. Her ashes were spread over at Bodhinyana Monastery. He's getting a bit old now. He'd always come every year to a Bodhinyana Monastery. Became a really, really dear friend. And it's wonderful that you actually could take a person like that and turn them totally around and turn their tragedy into something that they could understand, accept, and move forward with so they could actually be better people as a result. And these are wonderful things you can actually do. So to be able to have that compassion and that wisdom to really make a difference in life, that's what you can do. Many of you have been coming here for years. You know all my stories. They haven't got sort of copyright. Don't even know. This guy rang me from South Australia years ago. And he said, I just read your book, Open the Door of Your Heart. I really like it. I like to use it. He said, the problem is, like, I'm an evangelical Christian. I'm going converting some of your people. Can I use your stories? And of course I said, of course you can. I don't care what you use them for. They're good stories. They help people. They make people happier. Use them, fine. So I don't know how far he went with that. I was really hoping that he'd read enough of those stories that they would convert him. But who knows? That was the plan. But anyway, of course, no, just you can use them. So like, spread that happiness and peace in life, and that should really be your motivation. So don't just come here and listen. Go out there, and if it's a good story, a good attitude, a good idea, go out there and use it. If you can't actually do social work or voluntary work, at least you're working with other people in the community. You've got your friends, you've got your neighbors, you've got people you can actually help. Be kind and live your life for the happiness and benefit of all sentient beings. Make that your motivation and go and do it. Now that can really motivate you and get you and do things and make you feel alive, gives you meaning. It may not give you as much energy as kill all the baddies, get rid of the bikies, get rid of the corrupt politicians, get rid of... But it's a much purer, harder work, grassroots. But my goodness, it works. It makes a better society and gives you a meaning, a motivation to get up in the morning and do things. So that's motivation for you. Don't just sit there. Actually, no, you're supposed to do that, aren't you? You're supposed to sit there and meditate. But don't just always sit there. Sit there and meditate, yes, but also go and help the society. Thank you for listening. Okay, any questions about my motivational talk this evening? Is none of you motivated to put your hand up for the benefit of all sentient beings? Yes, thank you, Lawrence. You're a very kind man. Okay, social change is saying that you were involved in a forest campaign early on down south and you had to get in the way of the loggers or the trucks and the bulldozers and stuff. Any comments? I'm not quite sure whether you thought you succeeded in the short term, but you certainly succeeded in the long term. Because sometimes the people want quick results. They want that particular coop of forest to be saved. Maybe, you know, you lose the battle, but you win the war, as they say. And I don't mean that in a militaristic sense. So sometimes it's still a very good thing to do, to act compassionately. Sometimes you can be assertive. You know, you could actually stand in the way of the trucks, but you don't sort of get the other people to stand in the way of your fist. So, you know, at least be non-violent, be compassionate. It is for the benefit and... the benefit and happiness of all beings to preserve those forests for the future. And also to preserve the jobs for people. So whatever's the balance for everybody concerned. But it is good to actually to be active, socially active, but in a sort of a passive way. Not a passive way, I mean a non-violent way, sorry. That's what I meant. So I get involved in things every now and again. You see my picture in the newspaper like last Saturday. Standing up for things I believe in. Sometimes you take a bit of flack for that, but it's worth it. Standing up for the bhikkhunis, for the nuns, the women ordination, standing up for gays. So, you know, you take a bit of flack. You've got to take that. That's part of your job. But you do it not for yourself. You do it for the compassion, for the benefit and happiness of all beings. Anybody else? Going, going. Gone.